Welcome to Forums for a Future. No, it's not 1960. It's nearly half a century later. But, once again, there are warnings of danger all over the land. It's time, once again, to reclaim a future that is free of war, racism, and poverty. A brighter future of promise and hope. I am Edward Renner, your host for a series of civic discussions, forums, if you will, toward creating a more viable future. The complete outline for the podcast series and all of the reference materials are available on the Forums for a Future homepage on my website at www.kerenner.com. It is not sufficient to complain about the present. One must also have a prescription for the future. Podcast number 12, World Citizenship, Not Citizenships of the World. Part 1 of the series contains a brief 2-minute promotional and conceptual foundation for thinking about change as the convergence of economic, political, social, and personal perspectives. Part 2 is a set of 4 podcasts providing a philosophy for the 21st century. Part 3 is a set of 4 podcasts describing 3 lessons from modern history on the interplay of power, wealth, and belief for informing the present. Part 4 presents 3 prescriptive principles for having a future. Today, in podcast number 12, I will discuss the first of these 3 principles, world citizenship, not citizenships of the world. This concept, world citizenship, not citizenships of the world, describes the appropriate interplay of power, wealth, and beliefs as a political perspective for the new postmodern era of the 21st century. There are 2 complementary dimensions to citizenship that I wish to explore today. They are, first, the decline of citizenship as civic responsibilities, and second, the rise of citizenship as ethnic and national identities. The first meaning of citizenship is captured by the notion of being a good citizen. This implies doing those things on which community cohesiveness is based. The second meaning usually implies a geographic location and is descriptive of either an ethnic or national identity. The decline of the first, civic responsibilities, and the rise of the second, ethnic and national identities, is the exact opposite of what is essential for making the transition from the national to the global perspective required for the new postmodern era. We are moving in the wrong direction. Let's start first with the decline of citizenship as civic responsibilities. Members of any community have responsibilities to their community, or else there is no community. Community has traditionally been centered on one's own village, where the inhabitants were almost exclusively interdependent on each other. But now, with globalization, we often have more in common and are more interdependent on others who may be thousands of miles away than we are on the person next door. As an example, I routinely communicate in both personal and professional ways with friends and colleagues who live thousands of miles away, more than with my closest neighbor. This new reality has direct personal, economic, social, and political implications for how we now need to fulfill our civic responsibilities. First, at the personal level, civic citizenship gives us the experiences we feel and understand as belongingness. Often this belongingness is centered on those we consider our family. In our mind, we may know we are increasingly interdependent with distant others, and that we belong to a larger unit, humanity. But emotionally, we gain our personal sense of belonging from family and friends with whom we share space, time, labor, food, and shelter. Although it's understandable how our personal sense of self is deeply rooted in this kind of belongingness, the personal challenge of our time is in constructing more inclusive alternatives for defining our sense of self. Meeting this challenge will determine whether we are able to make a successful transition into the new era we are entering. This is why I began my podcast with a series of episodes I called A Philosophy for the 21st Century. That philosophy, the philosophy of constructive alternativism, is about the capacity to successfully respond to times of change by developing alternative personal perspectives, particularly changing those perspectives on which our own sense of self, our sense of belonging, is based. Second, at an economic level, as I discussed in podcast number 6, one of the defining economic features of the new postmodern era of the 21st century is corporate escape from regulation that globalization has permitted. Globalization has allowed corporations to escape from the civic duty of citizenship. Containing this escape has been a continuous struggle throughout the evolution of the industrial, scientific, and technological changes of the previous modern era. But now, in this new era, there are no longer economic connections with any clearly defined community, other than unrestricted growth and financial return to corporate investors. Without civic responsibilities, global economic forces are free to escape national boundaries, and therefore both the bonds of employee loyalty and the obligations of regulation and taxation that compose civic citizenship. Third, at the social and cultural level, the most important impact of a global economy based on unlimited growth is the resulting impact on the earth and on the capacity of the planet to support the economic pursuit of greater and greater consumerism, the best known of which is the impact of climate change and, in particular, global warming. If we continue on the current path, the collective footprint, that is, the demands of the people of the world, will be larger than the available supply of food, water, and energy. However, unlike the collapse of isolated societies in the past, societies that outstripped the capacity of their local land to support their expanding lifestyle, there is no place else to go. The social collapse about which Jared Diamond has warned us is human life as we know it on this planet. Societies in the past that have successfully sustained themselves for thousands of years did so through political structures that enabled them to recognize these challenges soon enough to be able to make significant changes in their lifestyle. Now, however, in the context of globalization, we are talking about one society, the human enterprise, and one geography, the planet itself. Thus, the emerging imperative is for world citizenship, not for competing citizenships of the world that place national self-interest first and collective preservation second. And finally, at the political level, the most important issue of the postmodern era is winning the fight against the new global economic imperialism. If national boundaries continue to define who the players are, the result will be a winner-take-all struggle between nations for survival in a zero-sum game. That is what the politics of our time is about. It is about rejecting territorial space of a nation as the significant unit and rising above the limited perspective of the separate citizenships of the world. A global economy within the finite capacity of global resources also requires more effective global politics. We need to think beyond national boundaries to the larger context of world citizenship to be able to hold corporations accountable for their global civic responsibilities. Of course, the stark reality is that we lack a political structure that has this capacity. At the city level, we have a mayor and a city council. At the state level, we have governors and legislatures. And at the national level, we have a two-party system with a president who is also commander-in-chief. As such, this single person and the largely invisible Foreign Service and Central Intelligence Agency are responsible for how our nation relates to the world. But we have no structure to give us a direct voice in the world, only an indirect voice through national politics. There is no comparable world political structure to our local, state, national political structures that give us, or anyone else in the world, a chance to become citizens of the world. The structure we have, the United Nations, allows only our indirect participation through our individual nation states. We know, in our dealings with other people, that it is sometimes hard to make cooperative choices rather than competitive ones, often to our mutual disadvantage. Likewise, it is especially hard for nations, and in particular powerful nations, such as the United States, to act cooperatively with other nations, rather than to act on simple self-national interest. At present, the best we can do is to try and hold our own country accountable to be a full and cooperative partner in world politics as we continue to search for stronger and more effective ways for claiming world citizenship. Clearly, our collective future now surpasses national boundaries. Thus, all four elements, the personal, economic, social, and political, are all conspiring to reduce the relative strength of citizenship as civic responsibility. This decline is directly proportional to the rise in citizenship as either ethnic or national identities that move us toward less, rather than deeper, engagements of mutual accountability with others. And now, let's consider the second aspect of citizenship, the rise of citizenship as ethnic and national identities. In his book, Blood and Belonging, Michael Ignatieff sees ethnic and national identities as the cause of conflicts around the world, such as in Croatia and in Serbia, and have now been unleashed by the United States within Iraq. These ethnic and regional conflicts have placed the militarism of the Cold War that previously divided the world into two opposing spheres of influence. This two-sided division subjugated these ethnic and regional differences to less intrusive sources of world tension than they are today. These traditional sources of personal identity, based on either blood, religious or ethnic affiliations, or national belonging, patriotism, have always been an excuse for having those who are the most marginal be the warriors who fight war for the benefit of the lords, whether they be chiefs, presidents, or brokers of wealth. But now, patriotic nationalism in the United States and its close relative of religious and ethnic identification are the most dangerous forces on the globe. And it is not just radical Islamic fundamentalism that has put the world at risk, but it is also the coalition of the religious right and the neoconservatives in the United States who have aroused national self-righteous patriotism as the motivation for both the invasion of Iraq and for the suppression of dissent. These two instances of blood and belonging, captured by the slogans of Jihad and God Bless America, have pushed the world close to disaster through misguided expressions of ethnic and national citizenship. Gwen Dwyer describes the depth of the current danger in Chapter 5, The System Such as It Is. He begins this chapter in his book by writing, I quote, "If we could have a safer, fairer, global order through the unilateral exercise of American power, many people in the West, although not elsewhere, would reluctantly accept that solution. After all, the United Nations has not exactly been an unqualified success. But most people suspect that Pax Americana won't work, because Americans will not be willing to bear for long the burden of high casualties and high taxes that such a policy involves. What we risk ending up with, instead, is a world in which all the old institutions of international governance have been destroyed or gravely undermined by the actions of the neoconservatives. But the rival American bid to provide world order has crashed and burned. We may end up with nothing, in other words, no working multilateral institutions, and little by way of international cooperation." Close quote. Ever since nuclear war became a reality, there has been no such thing as uninvolved bystanders in world politics. If war had occurred between the superpowers during the period of the Cold War, the whole world would have been the loser. That reality was what made the United Nations a necessity, and why it survived when the League of Nations, following World War I, did not. The UN did what it was supposed to do. It got the world through the Cold War and created a structure for international cooperation and world peace through rule by law, not unilateral military actions. This is not to say that the UN achieved this remarkable outcome flawlessly or without considerable strain and challenge. But the UN, however imperfectly, delivered the world to the threshold of a prospect for peace. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union, the resulting peace dividend made it possible for the UN to begin to address the other pressing social, economic, and humanitarian issues of the world. In the last decade of the modern era, the door was opened to the possibility of expanding the role and mandate of the United Nations from peace to one of better world health, more universal human rights, and less world poverty as the mechanism of choice for abating the seeds of terrorism and regional tensions. Given the magnitude of the social, economic, environmental, and health issues facing the world, it is certainly debatable as to whether the nations of the world, through the UN, could have reacted with sufficient quickness and decisiveness to confront the growing challenges of world collapse. But at least there was hope. There was a structure, and there was a precedent. all of this significant progress and hope were undermined in less than a decade by George W. Bush and the neoconservative fantasy of diverting the peace dividend, which held hope for the world, into a deliberate strategy for creating a worldwide U.S. military supremacy that could not be challenged. This was accomplished by fanning the flames of patriotic nationalism in the United States as the response of choice to 9/11, and which was so uncritically accepted by the American people as to be a conspicuous display of the failure of citizenship as national identity, in contrast to the missed opportunity for mutual accountability that marked the worldwide response to that event. What the United States did under the leadership of Bush and the Republican Party was to stop world political progress dead in its tracks and to undermine the hopeful efforts for world peace and for rule by order, not by force. This is why the world needs the United States back, not as self-appointed perpetrator of world order, but as a participating citizen of the world. The world needs the strength of the United States for leadership that will take international affairs out from under the vengeance of blood and belonging and place it squarely in rule by law and order. Participation in world citizenship is essential for international order. There is a long list of open-ended steps that can be taken unilaterally by the United States to advance mutual accountability as the prescriptive formula for the future. Throughout the history of the United States, there has always been a contradiction between the founding democratic principles of equality contained in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and our actual national history of slavery and imperialism. As Cornel West has written in Democracy Matters, and I quote, "The most painful truth in the making of America, a truth that shatters all pretensions of innocence and undercuts all efforts of denial, is that the enslavement of Africans and the imperial expansion over indigenous people and their lands were undeniable preconditions for the possibility of American democracy. There could be no such thing as an experiment in American democracy without these racist and imperial foundations." Close quote. The question raised by West is whether this experiment into democracy, barely 200 years old, can resolve this contradiction and fulfill its grand aspirations, or whether it will succumb to the opposing anti-democratic tradition of its history of racism and imperialism. West's answer is positive. He sees in the American culture the capacity to preserve, not to lose, the essence of what this great experiment in democracy is about. The grand experiment in the United States, more than in any other nation, has defined the essence of the modern era. The question is whether this nation can make the adaptations and changes necessary to translate our democratic heritage to the postmodern era. If America is to actually fulfill the ambitions of this democratic experiment, West argues that we must, and I quote again, shore up international law and multilateral institutions that preclude imperial arrangements and colonial invasions, and that facilitate the principled transfer of wealth by massive investments in health care, education, and the preservation of the environment. Close quote. But America cannot be the guardian of democracy, as the Bush administration has professed it to be, by anti-democratic abuses of power at home, and by, as West writes, an imperial vision of America as a lone sheriff, unilaterally policing a world more and more dependent on foreign oil, trade, and investment, while obscene wealth inequalities escalate at home. If a vision of world democracy is to prevail, we must win the fight against imperialism. The responsibility for doing so is largely up to us, the citizens of the United States, because it is the U.S. that is currently the greatest threat to the future. We cannot export the vision of world democracy through the unilateral exercise of military power based on maintaining the economy of empire. Democracy does matter, and it must be nurtured at home through the preservation of our democratic process, and only be exported by example through respecting democratic principles in the exercise of our foreign affairs. Reclaiming our democratic heritage is the world leadership that the United States is uniquely able to provide, and which is essential for our own survival and for the survival of the great democratic experiment as a world exhibit. As a start, what if the United States sponsored the authorization by the United Nations of official certificates of world citizenship? What if everyone in the world had an individual opportunity to apply for this document, with or without the approval of their national government? How long would it take for individual nations to recognize the legitimacy of this form of dual citizenship? How long would it take for the United Nations itself to start to evolve toward a structure that reflected popular, not just nation-state, participation? I cannot think of any more effective way to start to promote the notion that democracy matters, and to officially legitimatize the concept that world citizenship has a rightful place alongside the national citizenships of the world. At a less idealistic level are the very practical steps that separate nation-states can take of moving toward rule of law on political, economic, and social issues, similar to what was required to create international mechanisms for enforcing the principle that nations cannot gain territory through military actions. This can also be accomplished in the economic and social areas. One starting place for the United States is to embrace and officially sign existing treaties and declarations of the UN that have previously been rejected, such as the Cato Accord on Global Warming, the Convention of the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, or which have been withdrawn from, such as the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and the International Court of Justice. And to make these international treaties and obligations enforceable through the courts as the law of the land. Yes, it is true that gaining world consensus usually makes such treaties and declarations largely voluntary, but agreement on the principle is the starting point. These are all discrete elements, none of which are sufficient, but all of which are necessary. They are the individual baby steps that can be accomplished, one at a time, as feasible, without the necessity of a unified, simultaneously coherent master plan. If a treaty or accord advances the common good, for however an isolated issue, that is a step forward. But ultimately, the smallest common denominator is the individual. On the one hand, as individuals, we need to believe in the philosophy of constructive alternativism. Once we acknowledge that significant reconstruction of our core beliefs are required, we can then act on those beliefs and gain the subjective experience of a coherent sense of self-direction. We can feel a sense of purpose, and as a result, make direct contributions to a growing tide of civic awareness and civic responsibility that are the seeds of change. Many of us already have flagpoles from which to display the flag of the United Nations as a reminder to ourselves and to our neighbors of the need for world citizenship. The rest of us can easily get them from a flag store. We can listen to public radio and other alternative news and information sources, such as YouTube and Current TV. We can organize and participate in family and public political forums that are described in the next section of this podcast. The youth and the adults of today are now joined together as one, as both the authors and the recipients of one collective future. Thank you for the day.
How many times must the
No, it is not 1960, and I am not living in the past. It's nearly one half of a century later, and I am looking into the future. There's an urgency now to finish what was started then. It has taken another war, another replay of Vietnam, to bring us full circle. But this time, there is the absolute necessity of putting into practice what was then seen as the exuberance of idealistic youth. Well, it's no longer youthful idealism. It is our new reality for both the youth and the adults of today. Either we embrace fundamental economic, political, social, and personal change, or we will forfeit our collective future. The youth and the adults of today have common cause for a cross-generational commitment, a commitment by the youth to lay claim to a viable future, a commitment by adults to revisit the idealism of their past, this time for actually creating a sustainable future. What an exciting time to be alive.